For everyone who loves books, this is Read On, the audiobook show on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome to Read On, the audiobook show from RNIB Talking Books. I'm your host, Robert Kirkwood, and on today's show, motherhood, loss, and an apothecary garden, as we take a deep dive into All My Wild Mothers with author Victoria Bennett. Plus, we'll find out what's new in the RNIB Talking Books Library. An intimate weaving of memoir and herbal folklore, All My Wild Mothers is a story of rewilding our wastelands and the transformations that can happen when we do. At 7 months pregnant, Victoria Bennett was looking forward to new motherhood and all that was to come. But when the telephone rang, the news she received changed everything. Her eldest sister had died in a canoeing accident. 5 years later, struggling with grief, the demands of being a parent carer for a young son, and the impact of deeper austerity, life feels very different to the future she had imagined. A move to a new social housing estate in rural Cumbria offers Victoria and her family a chance to rebuild their lives. Constructed over an industrial site, at first, the barren ground seems an unlikely place to sow the seeds of a new life. I'll talk to Victoria Bennett in a moment, but All My Wild Mothers, Motherhood, Loss and an Apothecary Garden is read for you by Fenella Fudge.
Daisy, Bellis Perennis, Day's Eye, Bairnwort, Bruisewort, Poor Man's Arnica. To ensure your child is not replaced with a changeling, tie a daisy chain around their neck. The daisy symbolises childbirth, motherhood and new beginnings and is the sacred flower of the Norse goddess Freya. Linked to the spring equinox, it is a symbol of brighter times to come. Used in the Middle Ages to treat battle wounds, it's now a common remedy for bruising, joint pain, bronchitis and inflammation, as well as to support childbirth. The plant is high in saponins and can also be applied as a skin tonic to improve collagen. Daisy is a sign of resilience due to its ability to survive in disturbed wastelands. When I imagined our future, it held no grief. In that wished-for life, my husband and I live in a remote farmhouse with chickens in the doorway, fresh bread rising in the Raeburn, and our many children playing barefoot among the cottage flowers. During the day, I write in my whitewashed studio, and my husband paints at his easel, and at night, we share food and conversation with our friends. The reality is not this. What was meant to be our happy ever after has turned out to be our barely hanging on. It has been 4 years since my sister died and my son was born. Since then, I've walked like a ghost mother, broken by grief that wraps itself around me and will not let go.
All My Wild Mothers is my debut memoir, although I've been writing for many years, since I was a child, really, but writing poetry and publishing it for many years. This is my first book with so many words, is what I say to people. So it's my debut memoir, and it was written over a decade of care and grief. So it was written between the hours of those things, and it weaves together herbal folklore, kind of traditional wart cunning medicine, and personal memoir about grief and motherhood, loss, and the physical act of planting a wild apothecary garden with my young son in our new home, which was on a social housing estate in Cumbria, a new built one. And the estate had been built over old industrial ground, so we were planting into what was essentially just layers and layers of rubble, because the industrial ground had been a former stonework, so it not only had what had been the industrial buildings underneath the topsoil, but it also had 2 centuries of stoneworks rubble under it as well. And we grew that together on no money, just really with growing what would grow in this ground. And it was really the weeds beneath our feet that grew it. And we learnt together what properties they had and the folklore and the medicinal uses. And we grew food there as well. So it's about what grows, not in spite of what's broken, but because of it.
And what actually did you turn this journey into a book?
I didn't intend it. I think my intention wasn't a book at the beginning. Life was passing by very quickly, and I had been deeply, deeply in grief for the first years of my son's life. And also, I was also a carer for my son, who was diagnosed at the age of 2 with type 1 diabetes and was very, very sick because that had been missed for quite a while. And I decided that in between the care demands and the grief and all the rest of it and just the day-to-day, I wanted to try and put down on paper, put down in words the moments we were having. So I would, whenever I had a moment, I would light a candle and I would sit at my desk and I would write for as long as I had until I was called to do something else. And then I would blow the candle out and I would get back to what I needed to do. And sometimes that was 10 minutes and sometimes that was 2 minutes. And the chapters vary in length, I think, possibly reflecting the way that it was written. And it was about trying to put into words the things that had gone in my life. So because of loss, the things that had passed, and also to capture or to get as close to the moments I was living. And then after a long time, it became a book.
Who was it you were grieving?
Shortly before my son was born, or 2 months before my son was born, my eldest sister went out for a very undramatic canoeing trip to the River Eden, which she did frequently, and frequently canoed this stretch of the river. And she was in an accident and the canoe capsized and she drowned. So that changed everything in my life. And it was shortly before my son was born. So his birth became something that was tied forever, really, with a loss. And then in the years that followed, we experienced other losses in my life as well. So we lost other members of our family. It became really sort of 8 years of grieving one after the other.
So did that make it quite a hard book to write, or was there a certain catharsis there?
I think I didn't write the book as a therapeutic thing. I didn't start writing about my sister's death until this point. So obviously she had died 4 years previously, although some of the writing that went into All My Wild Mothers was written at the time as journal entries that I went and revisited. But it wasn't so much a catharsis as the opportunity to write closer to the whole experience. You know, when a shocking, I think when any death, but when a shocking death happens, the emotions are so intense, so acute, that I found I couldn't really write. I couldn't create from it. You know, it wasn't something that creativity would be cathartic for. I just had to live through it. But in writing it later, I was able to not only write about the grief, but remember my sister, remember moments from our lives together, and equally so remember moments from my childhood and my life, my family life, and this whole network of women and people around me, and revisit those memories that were at first glance maybe a bit like the ground under the garden. They were kind of rubble, But then revisiting them and writing into them allowed me to find the things that were growing there, and the joyful moments and the beauty in there. And it cathartic in that it gave me back a lot of joy that had been lost in the shock of the grieving.
I'm worn down and tired of failing to be the lover, the mother, the woman I thought I was meant to be. What little energy is left over from loss is exhausted by the constant pressure of debt. We are offered austerity as the cure. But it is harsh-lipped and cruel, cutting the safety nets from those who need them most. As the politicians talk of tightening our national belt, my husband worries about being a good father, about providing for his family. He's frightened that he will not be able to support us. He says that he should get a real job. I tell him that being an artist is a real job, and what we do matters, that we will survive as we always have. But we don't live in a culture that values what we can give, and it gets harder to do. The work gets less, the pay lower, the distance to travel further. He spends longer away, trading in the days of our son's early years for the hope of security later on. An echo of my own childhood days.
Now, you mentioned a network of women around you. We'll get to the garden in a moment, but first of all, tell us about Wild Women Press.
Wild Women Press was born in 1999, is when I founded it. I was 27, I think, at the time. And I kind of woke up one morning and went, I need to do this. It was one of those moments in life. And I decided that I was going to start initially with just putting up a poster, because it was pre-email days, pre-internet, pre-social media. And I put up posters around and invited women to come to my house and celebrate their stories. And it was an impulse to create a space for women to come together and share their stories and be authentic in that and feel supported in that. And I think partly that was because of my own experiences in life, and partly it was because I was working as a writer in mental health services, and a lot of the people that I was working with were women who were struggling with anxiety and depression. And I realized that some of the time, not all, but some of the time, that was helped by creating spaces for those people to feel able to tell their stories. And, you know, and that applies to all people. You know, it's Wild Women Press because it was named after the book by Clarissa Pinkola Estes, Women Who Run With the Wolves. And the wild woman is like the spirit of the wolf. So rather than it being a kind of a gender specific group, although initially all our members, our original members that joined, were women over, well, mostly older life, yeah, in older life.
The website is wildwomanpress.com. That's all one word. But I noticed on there, you were saying it airs towards the more mature person, but there's poetry, there's prose, but there's also gaming on there as well.
Yeah. So over the years, it's changed. So we've got a core group. You know, specifically, we've got a core group of wild women, and we still meet. We meet online now once a week, and we meet physically when we can once a year. So there's still that core group from that initial sort of gathering, which is wonderful. You know, that initial gathering, which was going to be 10 workshops, has ended up being like however long it is now. We're coming up for 24 years now. So really, it is family. It is a family of people. So that is that network of support of women that we've grown together. We've witnessed all these things together. But then the work of Wild Women Press, so it was initially set up to publish a poetry written by the group, because it was kind of, let's do it ourselves rather than trying to fit our voices into other people's. And then we worked with other women, like in total over about 2,000 women over the first decade, doing workshops and events and performances. And then as we've all sort of grown and moved on and energies have changed in terms of what we can put into it, we've looked at other things. The gaming one was started because I, with another hat on, I write for games and I use video games as a storytelling platform. And I did a project called My Mother's House, which was a playable poem in Minecraft, looking at terminal illness. So I started looking at and meeting other women who were working within the gaming industry, and I wanted to platform that. So that was that side. And then we also have the Wild Woman Web, which again is a space to share stories, but it's inviting women from all over the world. So we have like one guest writer a month who spins what we call a thread into the web. That's kind of a celebration of nature, creativity, connection, and it's writers, artists, musicians, creators, all sorts of different people all sharing their voices. And you know, we're moving more towards online work in that way, partly because my physical capacity to do work in other platforms has been greatly reduced, not because of COVID, but because of illness.
Plus, you're up in Orkney now as well, doesn't it?
And yes, but that's only a recent thing.
Right, let's get to the garden and all my wild mothers. What sort of things grew in the rubble?
So all the plants that are in the book, by the end of the 10 years, were growing in the garden. And they range from things like dandelion and rosebay willow herb, all the way to bluebell and red campion, broadleaf dock, sow thistle, lady's mantle, horse chestnut, foxglove. A lot of the plants in there would be the kind of things, and were the kind of things, that people were digging out of their own gardens and didn't want in them. And we claimed them and said, we'll plant them. And then we gathered seeds where we went as well and sowed those. So we ended up with a variety of wildflowers, as well as some trees, sort of cherry and apple and greengage, and then other plants that we would rescue from the bin lines of shops, you know, when they were bedraggled and nobody wanted them. So we grew huge lavender bushes out of these tiny little bedraggled lavender stumps that we planted at the beginning. We had different areas in the garden as well. So we had a pond and a bog garden and a little woodland area and a micro meadow and a sort of a micro forest and a vegetable planting area and a desert area. Bearing in mind, this is just in a small social housing estate garden. So they were micro areas, but we tried to make it as biodiverse as possible, partly because of an intention and partly because when the garden was planned, it was largely planned by my son, who was, he would have said 4 and a half and a bit at the time. The bit was very important.
Now, you said that it didn't start out as an apothecary garden, but it became one. So what did you actually use the plants for?
Well, I'm not, you know, I qualify myself in saying that I'm not a, you know, I'm not a licensed herbalist. I wouldn't be able to use plants to treat anybody else. But I return very much to the use of plants in how they would have more traditionally been used as part of our day-to-day knowledge. So for a practice that I have is that I go into the, well, I've just started doing again now in Orkney because I'm just starting to plant a new garden, but I would go into the garden and just see which plants, kind of intuitively pick the plants to blend into a tea through the day and kind of just drink that. So that would be a kind of more generalized thing. But again, I know what's growing in the garden, so I can do that fairly safely in terms of being able to identify things by smell and touch and sight. So intuitively picking plants, if you don't know what you're picking, is probably not wise. It's always good to find out what they are. But then I would also use specifically things like mint for digestion and feverfew for headaches and catmint for relaxation. Well, I must be part cat, I think. But, you know, as the garden grew, we learned more. I mean, I had a basic knowledge anyway when we started, and we learnt more over the years. And obviously, because we were growing what was by and large weeds, those are the plants that have the, you know, you'll find many of them at the base of a lot of medicinal or herbal treatments and herbalism. And in fact, a lot of modern medicine. I mean, foxglove, for example, you wouldn't use in its herbal state because it's incredibly toxic and dangerous to use. But it is the basis of modern heart medicine. You know, these weeds are what used to be our medicine chests.
You mentioned smell and touch. So would this garden be of benefit to someone with low or no vision?
I would say so. I mean, I think one of the beauties of wild gardening, because of the biodiversity of it, you get the sounds of the insects that it attracts. So you've got the bees, you've got, you know, I mean, there's so much sound in a wild garden. So you've got the wildlife that comes to the garden. You also have the sounds of the plants. So, I mean, one of the plants I love is honesty. They have the seed heads. They're sort of quite large, about the size of a 50 pence piece, and flat and smooth. And inside they have these flat, smooth seeds. And they have several of those on a thin branching stem. And in the autumn when they're seeding, they rattle when there's a breeze. So you get this wonderful percussion, and the same happens with a lot of grasses and things. So you have a percussive garden, and you have, you know, layering onto that, you would have the sounds of the insects, which, you know, ranging from like the deep thrum of a bumblebee all the way through to the kind of the cricket type sounds that you get in the grasses. And, you know, we ended up having frogs, bullfrog in the garden, so we had that deep sort of booming bass. And so you've got an orchestra in your garden. And you've got the birds as well, obviously, so it attracts all the garden birds with all of their different songs that come in. So you've got these vocalists coming in as well. So, you know, a wild garden itself, it is like going to a concert in the Royal Albert Hall, I think. But then you've also got smell. So a lot of wildflowers won't rely on smell. You know, they tend to be much more kind of bright colors or things that will catch the insects. So they use a different tactic, but some of them do have, you know, great smells. So obviously the lavender bushes that we had in the garden, we put in the front of the house where it was the worst ground, because they love growing in terrible ground. And the children on the estate used to go past and to school, and as they went past, they would always brush their hands along the lavender. And when the postie came to deliver post, they would have to go through the lavender bushes to get to the door. And everybody used to say how much they loved that, because it would release this smell of lavender into the air, which, you know, so often is a nostalgic smell for people. Nostalgic scent, it brings back, you know, these memories. And you've also got, you know, the earthy smells in the grass with clove. You know, if you're allowing things like clover to grow in your grass, then it produces this, you know, this rich smell. So if you're lying on the grass, you've got this earthy scent, and then the mints and the herbs growing in create this freshness. So I could go on.
What do you think's your favorite part of herbal folklore then?
My favorite part, I love the names. You know, I in writing the book and in gardening, in Created Garden, you know, I looked into a lot of the common names, and they tell so much about the plant and their uses. But also I find it really interesting because they tell you a lot about both how they grow, so the kind of botanical aspect of it, but also their medicinal uses that then are later proved in scientific studies. So the book starts with the plant rose bay willow herb. And I'm not even going to attempt to try and say the Latin name, because I just can't get my tongue around them. But the common names are passion fire and bombweed. It's a pioneer plant, and it grows best in scorched ground. So it's one of the first plants that will appear in ground that's been burnt. And it got its name bombweed because it grew in the bomb craters during the Blitz. So when London was blitzed, suddenly this tall, willowy, pink-headed, beautiful plants started growing in the craters out of the rubble and the destruction, which I think is such a beautiful kind of combination of both telling us what the resilience of the plant, but also about that hope that comes in resilience of what can grow once something's been destroyed.
One thing we won't get if we download the book from RNIB is the cover. Can you describe that for us?
I love the cover of the book. It was created by an illustrator called Lydia Blagden. And one of the things I love is that it was hand-painted. So you get an imperfection in it. So the cover in itself is a midnight blue. And the typeface, All My Wild Mothers, is in white. And again, that's been hand-painted. So it's not perfect, which I love. Underneath the title is a subtitle in a kind of soft yellow, which is Motherhood, Loss and an Apothecary Garden. And again, it's slightly wonky, you know, it's a slightly wavy line if you look closely at it. And then into the midnight blue cover is very faintly the image of a wall or bricks in a slightly lighter blue. And this cover goes all the way around, so the bricks go round onto the back, and then onto the cover itself is the motif of the dandelion, which for me, you know, speaks so much about what the book is about, which is about that resilience and life and growth and joy and beauty that can come out of broken places. So we start in the left-hand corner of the book, the lower left-hand corner, with the beginning of the dandelion just coming into bud, and it's sort of spiky leaf, toothed leaf, reaching up towards the title. And then you follow the stem of the dandelion as it winds its way round to the lower right hand side, where it starts to come into bloom. And then sort of the middle of the book on the right hand side, you've got the dandelion in its full bloom in this beautiful yellow. Then it starts to creep up towards the top right hand corner of the book, and it's beginning to close then and die back down. And then as it goes over towards the top left-hand corner of the book, it turns into that wonderful, billowy, sort of magical seed head that a dandelion creates. And then it scatters its seed and it goes back down into the ground. And that motif follows all the way around, weaves its way around onto the back of the book as well. And the back of the book lists in white and gold that some of the key plants that were in the garden, but also plants to tell the story. So nettle to offer protection, hawthorn to ease heartbreak, goldenrod to find hidden treasure, daffodil to begin anew. So to me, the cover tells the story of the book, tells the story of the life that's within it, and also kind of represents the way that the book has gone out into the world, which I like to kind of think of it. It's kind of like dandelion seeds. It's scattering. It's been blown out there, and hopefully will reach and kind of plant itself into people's lives and bring something to them.
Cleavers, Galium aperine, sticky willows, clivers, goosegrass, robin run the hedge. Use cleavers to help increase tenacity and bind commitment. Cleavers were traditionally used to treat venomous bites. All parts of the plant except the root are edible. Astringent, tonic, diuretic, and anti-inflammatory. It's commonly used as a tincture or infusion to cleanse the lymphatic system and boost immunity, or as a tonic to improve skin radiance and reduce signs of aging. Cleavers grow abundantly in hedges and on waste ground.
It is available in print and in ebook, and of course we're on the audiobook show, so it's available in audio as read by Fenella Fudge. What did you think of her reading of it?
It's an interesting one, because initially I was worried about having somebody else read this story that was so personal. You know, it felt like, oh, but it's so close to me, I want to read it myself. But circumstances were that it became, you know, Fenella was obviously going to be a the right choice for it. But actually, the experience of having somebody else read my words and read my story has been really quite amazing. So, and it enabled me to be able to sit with the story after it came out and listen to it. And that was a completely different experience. Had I read the book again after it came out, I probably would have been looking for all the typos. But listening to it allowed me to sort of step back a little bit and hear my story as told by someone else. And it actually was, I found it really, really moving in a very deep place. The sort of created a sort of sense of empathy and of love for myself and for the people in the book, which obviously I have anyway, but I wasn't expecting to be so moved. And Fenella reads it, you know, she reads it beautifully. And it was nice because as she was approaching reading it, there was the opportunity to kind of contribute to that with things like, you know, sort of conversations about my son, who has quite a lot in the book, you know, a big part in the book, and about his character and his voice and things. So yeah, I'm really happy with it.
You kind of answered my next question, but it was going to be, do you not fancy reading the book yourself?
I would have liked to have read it, but I think that it's also a great thing that Fenella Fudge has read it, and I get to read it when I do live readings, and I've done a few online readings as well. So having a memoir read by the person who's written it brings something to it, an extra level of intimacy, but equally having it read by somebody as experienced and you know, I don't actually think I could have read all of those Latin names.
And you're from a poetry background, which is sort of designed to be read out loud.
Yeah, I mean, I have done a lot of readings of work over the years with poetry. So I really enjoy going to places and reading it. And one thing that I'm kind of hoping happens is that, you know, maybe groups that meet online book groups or other types of groups, I might get an opportunity to go along to those places online and read. So I think being able to access things online is so important as well. You know, it's such a long overdue revolution that happened at a general level that I hope doesn't disappear altogether. One of the lovely things I like about the audiobook is that there's a very, very short bit of music in there, which is taken from a song that was created by a duo called the Bookshop Band, and it was inspired by the memoir. They're a folk duo, and they create songs inspired by books. They started off in a bookshop, and they did this song. So I really love the fact that in the audiobook it's got this little bit of the song that they created that inspired by the book. At my launch, we did an online launch, and they created a song and came and performed it as well, so which was brilliant.
Where do we call home when home is always shifting? All my life it has felt as though I'm only passing through, even though for 10 years I stayed still. For my 5 older siblings, this changing landscape was true. When my 2 brothers and eldest sister were 6, 4 and nearly 2, my father was relocated for the first time from England to Kuala Lumpur to set up a new factory. After that, his work as an engineer took him around the world, and where he went, the family followed. Soon after they moved to Malaysia, a second daughter was born, A year after this, they transferred to Australia and then New Zealand, where a third arrived. On they went to Mexico and Canada. By 1971, the year I was born, my mother had given birth to her sixth child and moved to her seventh country. We packed and left for Switzerland when I was 1 week old. Though they'd swapped their peripatetic life for a settled home by the time I turned five, my father didn't stay still. He continued to work his way around the world, and we remained, watching for his return. While he was gone, my mother took me to visit empty houses, picking them out from the estate agent's window for us to view. Together we roamed the overgrown gardens and wandered through the vacant rooms, imagining ourselves into this other life, until I could almost smell the sweet lilac growing by the door, or feel the heat of the fire in the empty grate. Each house would be the place, promising a future happiness just out of reach. But by morning, fault would be found, and a familiar sadness would fold itself around her again. The brochures would be rendered rubbish in the bin, and her good mood stoppered up like the pickle jars in the cupboard. I knew better than to ask if we would be moving, but at school I told stories about our new homes. Whatever it was that my mother hoped to find, she never found it there.
All My Wild Mothers, Motherhood, Loss, and An Apothecary Garden by Victoria Bennett is available now in ebook, audiobook, and in print. And Victoria, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it.
And Victoria will be back in a moment with the books of our life. But now, let's hear from Lynn Livingston about what's new in the RNIB Library.
National treasure Graham Norton is not only a beloved TV personality, but also an author. His fourth book is Forever Home, and it was gifted to us by the Hachette imprint, Coronet.
Peering over the shabby patchwork of roofs along the back quay was a strangely genteel terrace of houses. It looked out of place, like a guest who was hopelessly overdressed for the occasion. Formal in a way that made it unlike any other street in the town. Stable Row ran between Toomey's Lane and Barrack Hill. Just seven houses long, the small front gardens were all edged with the same metal railings, elegant rather than ornate. Most were well maintained. The people lucky enough to live in one of these houses took pride in their homes, aware of their good fortune. An ungenerous neighbour might have described them as smug. Doors were glossy, windows clean, the gutters weed-free. Originally built for the British officers who had come to the town as part of a small garrison, the short terrace still felt more Anglo than Irish.
Carol is a divorced teacher living in a small town in Ireland. A second chance at love brings her unexpected connection and belonging. The new relationship sparks local speculation. What does a woman like her see in a man like that? What happened to the wife who abandoned him all those years ago? But the gossip only serves to bring the couple closer. When Declan becomes ill, things start to fall apart. His children are untrusting and cruel, and Carol is forced to leave their beloved home and move back in with her parents. Carol's mother is determined to get to the bottom of things, refusing to see her daughter suffer in this way. It seems there are secrets in Declan's past, strange rumours that were never confronted, and suddenly the house the couple shared has taken on a more sinister significance.
At this time of the morning, all was quiet. Mrs. Buttimer, now widowed, from Number 1, was away visiting her sister in Dublin. A poster for a missing cat, faded and damp, hung from the gate of Number 2, all hope now drained away. A bright plastic ride-on tractor toy was parked neatly on the path leading to the front door of Number 3. The children ferried off to school a couple of hours earlier. The morning light glittered as it struck the small crystals hanging in the windows of Number 4. Jenny and Arthur Beamish could never have been described as hippies. He was a retired accountant. But they embraced the trappings of middle-class bohemia. They had hung some wind chimes by their front door until Mrs. Buttimer had complained of sleep deprivation.
Forever Home by Graham Norton is read by the author and lasts 8 hours 44 minutes.
We now have the 24th book in the Inspector Rebus series in the library, thanks to Orion. It's Ian Rankin's latest book and it's called A Heart Full of Headstones.
Rebus had tried to look shaken by the outburst. The judge had asked if he needed a minute. Maybe a glass of water, Your Honour, Rebus had said, trying to summon up a few beads of nervous sweat. All of this while Malone was being taken from the courtroom, cursing Rebus and his corrupt kind to the rafters. The jury will ignore what they've just heard from the accused, the judge intoned. Then to the advocate deputy, you may continue if Detective Inspector Rebus is ready. Detective Inspector Rebus was ready.
John Rebus stands accused, on trial for a crime that could put him behind bars for the rest of his life. Although it's not the first time the legendary detective has taken the law into his own hands, it might be the last. What drove a good man to cross the line? Or have times changed, and the rules with them? Detective Inspector Siobhan Clark faces Edinburgh's most explosive case in years, as a corrupt cop goes missing after claiming to harbour secrets that could sink the city's police force. But in this investigation, it seems all roads lead to Rebus, and Clark's twin loyalties to the public and the police will be tested to their limit.
He tried to recall the first time he'd set foot in Tynecastle Cop Shop. Would he have been a DI or a detective sergeant? Probably a DS. He had never been based there himself, though for a time he had worked out of nearby Trefeken. But Trefeken was practically Edinburgh's salubrious West End. Tynecastle, tiny to those acquainted with it, was a tougher proposition altogether.
A Heart Full of Headstones by Ian Rankin is read by James McPherson and lasts 11 hours 42 minutes.
And finally, thanks to HarperCollins, we have the thrilling The Institution by Helen Fields.
At 30 years of age, her skin tone was healthy, her flesh firm and unmarked. Thin white lines from shoulder to breast evidenced a bikini worn somewhere hot. She'd liked being outside, enjoyed the feel of heat on her body. It was a hopeful thing to holiday. A passing of time and the belief that you had enough of it left to simply enjoy, to forget yourself a while and be frivolous.
Dr. Connie Woolwine has 5 days to catch a killer. On a locked ward in the world's highest security prison hospital, a scream shatters the night. The next morning, a nurse's body is found and her daughter has been taken. A ransom must be paid and the clock is ticking. Forensic profiler Dr. Connie Woolwine is renowned for her ability to get inside the mind of a murderer. Now she must go deep undercover among the most deranged and dangerous men on earth and use her unique skills to find the girl before it's too late. But as the walls close in around her, can Connie get the killer before the institution gets her?
Connie wondered what Tara would have done with that vacation time if she'd known what fate had in store for her. Spent it with family? Or putting her affairs in order? Written letters to those she loved to help them through the coming darkness? Another downward fold of the sheet. Breasts unharmed, just starting to swell with first milk. Speckled with blood that had dried to minuscule, blackening flakes and left her smooth skin roughly textured. To the sides, her upper arms reflected cruel fingers that had clenched hard enough to leave bruises, the ghosts of a man who had been swift and merciless in restraining her. Thumb marks on the inside of her arms, fingers on the outer flesh. Tara had looked him in the face then, known the man who would go on to kill her. His face would have been as close as Connie's was to Tara's now.
The Institution by Helen Fields is read by Genevieve Swallow and lasts for 12 hours, 54 minutes.
If you have a question about living with sight loss, no matter how big or small, the RNIB helpline is here to offer support. Whether it's connecting to your Wi-Fi or connecting to your community. From remote banking to TV remotes. Call us on 0303 123 9999 or say, Alexa, call RNIB helpline for more information. RNIB, see differently.
From new books in the library to some book recommendations, both old and new. A return to Victoria Bennett and the books of her life. Is there a book from childhood that made you fall in love with reading and writing?
Now, yes, it's got to be Little Women. Little Women, Louisa May Alcott, was a well-thumbed book in my childhood, and I still have it. I think being the youngest of four sisters was part of it, and wanting to write was another part of it. And it felt like home to me. And obviously I read it now later as in the context of where we are, but and it's slightly changed, but it's still a book that I love. You know, now I think I can look at it, I read it, and obviously there's historical context to it, and some bits are a bit kind of cringy, but it essentially it's still the same book. It's still about, you know, trying to be who you need to be in the world and be yourself and kind of find your path. And my allegiances and my empathies change as I read it as I get older, but still so much part of me growing up, and I can kind of recognise those sibling relationships, although we weren't like the women, Little Women.
The 1st of June. The kings are off to the seashore tomorrow and I'm free. 3 months vacation. How I shall enjoy it, exclaimed Meg, coming home one warm day to find Joe laid upon the sofa in an unusual state of exhaustion, while Beth took off her dusty boots and Amy made lemonade for the refreshment of the whole party. Aunt March went today, for which, oh, be joyful, said Joe. I was mortally afraid she'd ask me to go with her. If she had, I should have felt as if I ought to do it. But Plumfield is about as gay as a churchyard, you know, and I'd rather be excused. We had a flurry getting the old lady off, and I had a fright every time she spoke to me, for I was in such a hurry to be through that I was uncommonly helpful and sweet, and feared she'd find it impossible to part from me. I quaked till she was fairly in the carriage, and had a final fright, for as it drove off, she popped out her head, saying, Josephine, won't you... I didn't hear any more, for I basely turned and fled. I did actually run and whisked round the corner where I felt safe. Poor old Joe. She came in looking as if bears were after her, said Beth, as she cuddled her sister's feet with a motherly air. Aunt March is a regular samphire, is she not? Observed Amy, tasting her mixture critically. She means vampire, not seaweed. But it doesn't matter. It's too warm to be particular about one's parts of speech, murmured Joe. What shall you do all your vacation? Asked Amy, changing the subject with tact. I shall lie abed late and do nothing, replied Meg from the depths of the rocking chair. I've been routed up early all winter and had to spend my days working for other people. So now I'm going to rest and revel to my heart's content. No, said Joe. That dozy way wouldn't suit me. I've laid in a heap of books, and I'm going to improve my shining hours reading on my perch in the old apple tree, when I'm not having Don't say larks, implored Amy, as a return snub for the samphire correction. I'll say nightingales, then, with Laurie. That's proper and appropriate, since he's a warbler. Don't let us do any lessons, Beth, for a while, but play all the time and rest, as the girls mean to, proposed Amy. Well, I will if Mother doesn't mind. I want to learn some new songs, And my children need fitting up for the summer. They're dreadfully out of order and really suffering for clothes.
Gertrude Davis reading Louisa May Alcott's Little Women, available from RNIB Talking Books. And is there a book on a rainy day you go back to again and again for a comfort reread?
There is, and it would be Women Who Run With the Wolves by Clarissa Pinkola Estes. That was so informative for me and life-changing as a young woman in finding my own voice and forging my own path. She's a storyteller and a Jungian psychologist, actually, I believe is her background. So she tells stories, and that can be things from like the Red Shoes and the sort of traditional stories. The book is a combination of storytelling and then an examination of those stories and the motifs in them and the meaning, and then a kind of call to action and how it can relate to our own lives. So it's a very rich book in terms of what you get out of it. And she reads herself and she's just a fantastic storyteller. And it's full of the fairy stories that we grow up with, but also a lot of wisdom and wildness that is good to return to every so often to reground myself and remind myself of not being afraid to break the rules.
She sits by the fire and contemplates which song she will sing. And when she's certain, she stands over the criatura, over the creature, and she raises her arms over it and sings out. And that is when the rib bones and the leg bones of the wolf begin to flesh out and the creature becomes furred. And La Loba puts her arms again over the creature and sings some more. And more of the creature comes into being. Its tail curls upward, shaggy and strong. And La Loba sings more. And the wolf creature begins to breathe. And still, La Loba sings so deeply that the floor of the desert shakes. And as she sings, the wolf opens its eyes and leaps up and runs away down the canyon. And somewhere in its running, whether by the speed of its running, or by splashing its way into a river, or by way of a ray of sunlight or moonlight hitting it right in the side, the wolf is suddenly transformed into a laughing woman with long red and black and silver and yellow hair, who runs free toward the horizon. And so it is said that if you wander the desert, and it is near sundown, and if perhaps you are a little bit lost and certainly tired, that you are lucky, for La Loba may take a liking to you and show you something, something of the soul.
That's Clarissa Pinkola Estes reading from her own book, Women Who Run With the Wolves, Myths and Stories of the Wild Woman Archetype. Available wherever you buy your audiobooks. And is there a book you've read recently? It doesn't have to be a contemporary book, but something you've read recently you'd like to recommend.
A book that I'm reading at the moment is Alice Vincent's Why Women Grow, Stories of Soil, Sisterhood and Survival. And I'm reading it because there's an obvious conversation between All My Wild Mothers and Why Women Grow. Alice is coming at it, looking at it in terms of wanting to understand what leads women to grow gardens and want to plant and nurture the ground. And obviously I'm coming at it as somebody who is growing a garden. So I wanted to read it. It's a good companion to All My Wild Mothers. I've enjoyed it because it's an opportunity to kind of hear other people's stories about where their gardens have come from and where their love of gardening has come from. And I've actually really enjoyed listening to it in audiobook. I would recommend it as an audiobook.
For centuries, we have learned the soil's secrets. We have ushered herbs from the ground and dried them for healing. We have braided seeds into our hair to preserve legacies, even when the future looks bloody and uncertain. We have silently made the world more beautiful, too often without acknowledgement. I wanted to try and change that. I wanted to see the gardens that women made. I wanted to know what had encouraged them to go out, work the soil, plant seeds and nurture them, even when so many other responsibilities sat upon their shoulders. I wanted to know how their lives had taken them to this place and what it brought them now they were here. For 6 years, I had grown things with quiet compulsion on balconies, the first one smaller and brighter than the other. I had gardened through joy and through loneliness, through communality and through heartbreak. I had gardened to celebrate and to soothe. I had become dependent on plants, on looking at and to them, to feel balanced. After nearly 3 years of turning a shady strip of a balcony into a verdant, welcoming oasis, I was faced with a blank expanse of a back garden. I've always learned about plants through their stories, how they came here, what they represent, what silent powers they hold and who they mean something to. I have made my career as a storyteller. As a journalist, I have told stories daily for more than a decade. Now, I wanted to hear, perhaps even tell, these women's stories. I wanted to learn more about what had driven these women to garden, perhaps to better understand my own need for the soil, perhaps to better understand what it was to be a woman.
That's Fiona Hampton reading the audio version of Why Women Grow, Stories of Soil, Sisterhood and Survival by Alice Vincent. Available commercially. And Victoria, once again, thank you so much.
Thank you, Robert. It's been wonderful to chat to you and I've really enjoyed it.
We've got time for on today's show, but remember this show is also available as a podcast. There are over 300 episodes in your favourite podcast app. Just search for RNIB Read On. I'll be back at the same time next week, but remember our daily show, Talking Books, featuring the best the RNIB library has to offer, that we're allowed to play on here. That's every day at 7 a.m. with a different tale at 2 p.m. or 10 p.m. if you prefer a book at bedtime. The whole schedule is at rnibconnectradio.org.uk.